and welcome to the Atomicast. As always, I'm Alex Roy, and I'm here with my co-hosts Ed Niedermeyer and Kirsten Korosek. And this week we have a part one of an amazing interview with Dave Hall, founder of Velodyne, Marta Tomahal, president of Velodyne, and Anand Gopalan, the CTO.
To go from audio engineering to DARPA challenge, like what was the trigger to enter that? So
we were getting toward a CES time, and we were kind of in a panic. So we threw together some big 15-inch woofers, and we threw some servos on it. We took it to the CES show and opened them up. So we had 4 days of playing this unbelievably low bass that nobody had ever heard before. And then I found out that after 4 days of demoing the thing, my hearing, I couldn't hear right for about a month. And then forever after, if I heard deep bass, it hurt. So I was forever, you know, damaged by the very product that I was trying to sell. And this brings me back to the first show. It's just nonstop assault onto your earboard. So anyway, so that's how the audio started. So then I got caught by the tiger by the tail, because I couldn't drop the audio business, and you know, I kept selling some product, and then we came out with the ULD-15, and that was pretty successful, put me on the map.
You talk about the subwoofer I had in my college dorm.
Yeah,
excellent unit.
Yeah, that was, I worked hard on that engineering, and a lot of people liked it, and it did something that no other subwoofer could do at that time, play that deep and that clean. So it was kind of a new experience for everybody, and you know what, it was cool. And if you like that sort of thing, or if you could do it without your ears hurting, which was a unique problem that I suffered.
If you could
from.
Do it without being at CES, where every other company was selling, it was mostly audio back when you were.
Yeah, I sort of stumbled on it when audio was kind of in a resurgence, and that was just when the CD had come out.
Oh, okay.
And so there's kind of a resurgence, and CES show was kind of mostly audio at that time, I guess.
It's gone from mostly audio when you were kind of a star in that, and now it's mostly cars.
Yeah,
so
what
this
was
is
the
fascinating.
Leap? How'd you make that?
Well, the leap started about 1994 when I got this bad review in Stereophile about this.
Well, Stereophile, those guys can't be trusted even today.
No, they cannot.
I know.
I figured out the way to deal with Stereophile is I'm never, ever going to read a review of my products ever again. And then they can write whatever they want. They won't insult me, you know. So even true with these audio podcasts, I never read this stuff that anybody writes. So I'm permanently damaged by the audio business. So then in 94, I tried to plot my way out of the audio business. And so first I tried making integrated circuits. So I learned how to design them and build them, and I made a few circuits for audio. And then, you know, the audio business, it'd make some money, and then the recession would come, and it'd be nothing. So, you know, every recession come, I'd have to cut back all my new projects down to zero. So that the semiconductor got chopped, as we get put on the chopping block. And then the next one I tried to do is get into robots. So I started with the robot fighting wars to learn how to get robots, and thinking, you know, robots are going to be the next big thing in Silicon Valley, and I was trying to catch that wave. And then the robot fighting thing, we had a lot of fun with that. We got to see yourself on TV. So, you know, when
so
you're
were in, you in BattleBots?
We're doing BattleBots.
Right.
We did the BattleBots here.
Great show.
And then we did Robot Wars.
Excellent.
Which was... Remember the burning clown?
Yes.
That was me burning the clown.
Oh, awesome.
So, we...
Are you a fan of the movie Real Steel?
No, I haven't seen it.
Wise choice. It's like BattleBots, but with augmented VR control of the units. But let's move on.
Yeah, so that would be cool, too. And then there was a lull in that, and then DARPA announced the Grand Challenge. And I said, you know, this is a great extension of BattleBots. We get to drive real cars off cliffs, and... Which is, I'm sure, what we're going to happen. And then
drive
I could
real
show
cars off.
Off
cliffs?
Yeah, not, instead of these little tiny robots, we could wreck real cars.
Okay.
So that was
a premise. You knew that there was going to be destruction.
Yeah, it was just a question of what we were going to fill out on our insurance claims about how our car got destroyed.
That's a bit of a joke.
No, it's not.
No, serious. I looked at the DARPA thing as an excellent opportunity to spin the business, you know, start up another business. And then the question is, do you set that up as a separate enterprise, or do you run it within the existing enterprise, which was the subwoofer business? And as it turns out, the there's good and bad by doing that. So the good news is that we already had an established business, and that we had purchasing, we had manufacturing, we had design engineers, and these were all on staff that I could pull as needed under these new projects. So I kind of pilfered the audio company to help me build this first LiDAR. And to a certain extent, the audio suffered a little bit because I took all the good engineers and I put them on the LiDAR.
I was in charge of audio then. Yeah, I remember well.
That must have been an interesting discussion that would happen, right?
Oh, there was no discussion. No discussion, but very exciting times. I just tried to keep the audio division afloat while he developed the technology for the LiDAR, which took about 4 years.
And what was it about LiDAR? What made you sort of identify that as being sort of the important part of this?
Well, I went to the first Grand Challenge, and I built a stereo camera system, which I believe was state-of-the-art at the time. And I got to know the latest DSPs, which I'd written all the code for. And I had a kind of a slick setup. And I spent a lot of time playing with that and came to the conclusion I could see some of the road all the time and all the road some of the time, but I was never going to see all the road all the time with a stereo camera. And then so I went into the first race with that, and we got, I don't know, 7 miles or something like that and stuck on a rock. It's kind of a famous story. But then, I took a step back and say, you know, what does it really need to solve this problem? And I was gathering all the information I'd heard, the complaints from everybody who was at the first Grand Challenge, and a lot of what they were trying to solve was this problem of a phantom, false positives, where the car would pretend to see something and then stop, and it really shouldn't have stopped, should have kept going. So this noise that people had in their sensors, both in the enormous amount on the radars and to a certain extent in the cameras, was a real stumbling block for the computers. It really needed something more, much more black and white than the interpretation we can do as a human. I started to say, well, what does a sensor need? It's really robust. It'll never give you bad information. And then I started looking at the LiDAR as really the type of sensor that could be that reliable, that would only give you data that you could act on, wouldn't give you superfluous stuff that you had to filter through and average out. And I thought that, at that time, there was these flash LiDARs that were coming next year, you know, these solid-state ones that were going to do everything, and that was wonderful, and there wasn't any point in anybody developing a LiDAR. And I says, well, you know, the race is now. I can't wait next year. I got to build something now, so maybe I'll just build something that maybe it doesn't have an infinite life, but yet it solves the immediate problem, and I get some hardware that I can go compete in the race. And so that's when the spinning LiDAR was evolved out of that. But that first design I came up with is lives on today in this current product. So the current big thing was actually designed in theory before it ever turned a LiDAR on or ever seen the picture out of it. So it just turns out to be kind of a legacy design at this point, or a legacy.
When he made that design, it was a breakthrough in technology, because the way he explained it to me, which he skipped, and I just want to include it, and that is that he took what was a whole bunch of thousands of parts and put them all together into one solid-state part, because you had to do that in order to spin it. And the brilliance was spinning, because then you could take in the 360-degree view of the environment, which you need to fast when you're in real-time driving. You have to compute and take in data at the speed of light, so it has to be so fast. And the brilliance with the LiDAR compared to cameras is that it actually sees in measurements. It's a mathematical tool that Anand could explain, or David could explain, but it's completely different from camera, which is assumptions. Like, we make assumptions when we look at the movies, even. Like, we're that far from a tree. Whereas a LiDAR, you know, I'm exactly 6.825 meters from that tree. It's a huge difference when it comes to safety and driving autonomously.
Well, anyway, some of what went back in the LiDAR is that the DARPA announced that, well, we have all the sensors we need. We just need somebody with a secret sauce to blend it together. And, you know, we have enough radars and cameras and ultrasonics, and we just need the secret sauce, which was allegedly code word for coders that would write stuff that the old guys running the thing. But, you know, so I figured this had come from a government official, and a government official, I assume, is always wrong. So I says, you know, that no, this can't be, you know, what the real problem is, you don't have the right sensor. and despite that. So I went out with let's make a better sensor, because it was contrary to what the government was, DARPA was teaching is what they wanted. So, and then I wanted to be in the sensor business. So, because it's not a, and it was electromechanical, which is what I liked about it. So all of my projects are kind of a mixture of electrical and mechanical. So I sort of try to find projects that, that use a little of both. And, you know, yeah, I may not be the greatest mechanical engineer or the greatest electrical, but I can put the two of them together at the same time because I know both skills, and then I can make stuff that's I think is kind of amazing, or at least unique anyway. So I really liked the idea that it was, I said, well, I can either put this thing in a box and you can't see anything, or I can make it spin around. So I said, well, wouldn't it be cool if it spun around? At least then you'd know it was doing something. So the first product was spinning around kind of as an engineer's choice, you know, and because it looked kind of cool, and at least you could see it was doing something.
Add a little flash to it, right?
Yeah, and then everybody, you know, now the current products are just sort of blah things inside of a box, and yeah, they're spinning inside of our tube or whatever they are. Can't tell them spinning.
But right. That's the difference.
Anyway, so I used to see those spinning things go down the highway, and I says, "Yeah, that's a good-looking spinning thing." and then I hear the radio. It says, "Oh, these autonomous cars are great, but that thing is so ugly on top of the car." And I take it personally.
Yeah, it is. It's a signature of autonomous cars now, and it also turns out that it was the most efficient use of electronics, because he took the same piece of electronics and then spun it in a 360 degrees field of view, versus now trying to sprinkle the electronics around the car. It was a central sensor that spun around and basically reused the electronics effectively on a cheap spindle. So it's also really an efficient design. Even though David claims he did it because he thought it was cool, but it's a really efficient design.
So how challenging was it to develop, you know, it's a brand new sensor, right? The government didn't even know they wanted it. Nobody knew they wanted it. You created it. How hard was it to, like, turn this into a business, right? Was it just people saw it once at the Grand Challenge and you were just flooded with orders? Did you have to develop that business? What was that like, sort of making that transition from I built this entirely new thing to starting to commercialize it and then transitioning to where you are now, where you're starting to have all these major supply contracts?
Here's how well I predict the government. So they had already announced the third Grand Challenge, which was the same as the second one, the same as the first one. And I thought, okay, well, I got this killer LIDAR. You know, there's no way this thing cannot win this race. And they had already announced a $4 million prize for the fourth race. And I said, okay, so I'll just learn a little bit on this one, you know, get some experience, and then I'll be ready to go for the second one. So then, sure enough, there's some politics in the DARPA race, and Tony Tether was getting an awful lot of criticism for these things. And so they kind of dumbed down the race to the point where he had five winners or something like that. And then he says, okay, we're done. You know, get the hell out of the desert. And autonomous vehicles declared victory. And, so then, you know, everybody's all geared up. And then the whole rug was just pulled out from the industry when he did that. And so there was no orders, no nothing. So I went to DARPA, and I don't know why I was there, and I started to bitch at the guys about, you know, you got the whole industry revved up, and you got not taking advantage of it. And then I invited the guys out to look at my LIDAR. So we showed them the LIDAR, and then we sort of sketched out what the thing could do. And I says, you know, I can do 30, 35 miles an hour, and I can navigate streets and do stop signs and that. And from that sort of outcome of that was a concept for this urban challenge, which was, who's going to pay for my LIDAR? And I didn't want to take any government money. So then we said, well, how about if the government gives some money to the teams, and then the teams could give it to me for my LIDAR? And this was a win-win situation. So actually one of the guys sort of said there that, Dave, you know, you could be really selfish and keep this LIDAR, wonderful LIDAR technology for yourself, or you could be a real hero and make these things and sell them to the other teams, but then you wouldn't be able to compete in the race. And I went, well, okay, if I can be a hero versus an idiot or an asshole or whatever it is, then I guess I'll go the hero route. So then I engaged to get in the business to build, mass-produce these LIDARs. And then the result is you could see them on the Grand Urban Challenge, is that five of the six had my thing spinning on their top of their cars.
What happened after that then? I mean, was the reception, I mean, certainly the reception was positive, but then was your phone ringing off the hook, or did development kind of hit a pause? Because there was a bit of a quiet period where a lot was happening in academic research, but it wasn't what we see now, certainly, or even in the last like 4 years. So what happened in that sort of quiet period?
Well, the LIDAR got picked up by people making maps with it, and Navtech was the first company really to engage doing this, and they were out of Chicago at the time. And so we put together a fleet of cars, and they went around collecting 3D maps using the HDL64. And then that spun off into the current HERE project, H-E-R-E, which is, I guess, still... It was bought by Nokia, and some weird things happened. But so then we had a couple other guys doing mapping. So the first autonomous vehicle was Caterpillar, who had an interest, and they were participating in the Grand Challenge, and they decided to retrofit them on to their big mining trucks.
For the mining industry.
Still happening today. Yeah. So we know because the units come back and they're all full of this red dust.
Yeah. So there really wasn't a lull. There were just a whole lot of scientists who came out of that with potential to work on cars this way, and they started getting picked up by different companies like Google hired a bunch of the Stanford guys. Carnegie Mellon hired Red Whitaker's team, and it just went from there. You thought it was a lull, but actually there was all this activity going on. And so Velodyne Business was supported by the mappers, as David said, but then we also had Google and Novia. Who were the others? There were others that were interested in continuing their research on the autonomous driving.
Well, I don't know. Google for a while there was the only people doing anything.
Okay, so and, Google.
And then I was talking to the Google guys one day, and I says, you know, guys, people believe that this autonomous thing is real. And it was kind of a shock to them because they were just tinkering around with it. And they says, no, seeing is believing. If it looks like autonomous, acts like it must be an autonomous car. And so I think at that point, the success and had led people to believe that maybe this autonomous thing is real. And then people started to jump on the bandwagon because they sort of believed it's actually doable. And then it became a keep up with the Joneses kind of a concept. But it's all based upon the assumption that these cars actually can drive by themselves, which is not entirely clear that they actually can, actually.
So just for the record, Hall and Hall have just stated that it is not entirely clear that these cars can drive themselves.
Don't listen to David. You ask Marta.
I'm the last.
Marta will say something different. Okay, Marta and Anand have a different answer.
I'm the last.
Marta in charge.
I'm the last person that my customers.
So perfectionist.
Yeah, but my customers don't share with me the intimates of their details, their flaws, and their strategies. So there's a lot of this. It's a little close to the chest because it's a competitive race. So. What actually anybody's doing is you probably have a much better idea because you can actually get a ride in the car and judge for yourself.
When you sell these units, I mean, Velodyne is the state-of-the-art LIDAR, you're not privy then to how they're used, the R&D of your own customers. But they must come back to you with feedback and requests for changes in future iterations.
Yeah, and let's be clear, at that DARPA race, David became friends with all of those engineers working on all of those teams. Those guys are still friends today. They're going to have a DARPA reunion. Those top scientists at GM, top scientists at Ford, we're not in silos. We share. They want us to succeed. We want them to succeed. We partner with Baidu. We want them to succeed. It's kind of unbelievable in the sense that there's so much sharing, except for the weird competitors who have popped out of nowhere and they're trying to shoot us in the back. But other than that, everybody is really a big car team and wants this autonomous and advanced safety project to go forward. And that's very exciting.
Well, okay, but we're not really I don't run a company that's a bunch of joint ventures and partnerships. Is I'm kind of a standalone guy making a product. Here, use it for something or, go buy something else. So it's and to a certain extent, we try to sell finished products, and they're not really designed to build, and they're not custom designed for someone else. They're mass-produced by us for whatever they can do. Being a customer or a vendor to a car is not known to be a great business plan. And, you know, they tend to want to grind you down into a bunch of specs and then have a bunch of people bid on it. And then they want to open up your bill of materials and then rob you of all of your profit. And we're kind of trying to...
No, he's finding the negative part about it.
It's a two-way street, is we don't really want anybody knowing what's in our product.
True,
and then we don't ask what they're doing with it either.
So I will say this, though. You're being modest right now, but a couple of weeks ago, we had a conversation. We were talking about, like, new entrants to LiDAR. And I said, did you think that there was enough, you know, to go around? That there could be a couple of LiDAR companies that could exist. And at the time, you said, we're the only company, and we plan on dominating this landscape, which you're already doing. And then you even went, like, it was great, because it was the most honest thing I think I've heard any other companies say. You know, they're all like, we're all going to work together. This is going to be great. And you certainly took the opposite take on that, and, like, where you see this company going and where you see them sitting in sort of this autonomous vehicle space.
Yeah, but, you know, I get to, you know, there's never, you know, we're living in a world, there's never been more ways to make money than there is today. So you can kind of carve out your own niche of whatever you want to do. And, you know, kind of my products are, you know, they're kind of a statement of my engineering skills and not, and more than anything else. So I'm out there kind of bragging about what I can build or showing off, I guess, a little bit. So, you know, you're going to see that out of my products, that we don't, you know, if I can't make something that isn't a statement, then I probably won't bring it up through production.
So his technology is the best of the best, and so we're going to carve out the very, you know, autonomy. Autonomy needs for safety's sake. Do we want some patched together, hopeful camera? No, we want, you know, system. We want the best of the best to put our parents, our kids, people in it. We don't want to mess around with safety. So, and Velodyne is... We are the inventor. We have the patent on the spinning thing, so the others can't do that. But we do everything as well. We also have a not spinning one, just to show we can do that too. We have a solid state out at CES now, but we are the best in autonomous and have the patents on it. The others can carve out niches with level, you know, like Mobileye and low levels 1 and 2. They are safe enough for that, for fender benders and things like that. But if you're going to trust your life to a car that's going to have a backup system to be sure that you're going to, not be sure, but a better chance of survival, doing the best you can like a seatbelt did in the old days and airbags did. You want something that is highest quality, and that's what David does. You can tell he's a perfectionist.
Marta, you told me on the phone, though, a couple weeks ago, that actually you guys sort of chart or see a place for LiDAR not just with autonomous vehicles, though. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, you want to see
I'm
them
talking
in...
about advanced safety.
Yeah.
So you have from 0 to 5, those, are you familiar with those?
Of course, okay. Yeah.
We're deeply familiar.
I bet you're familiar.
Unhappily familiar with those
hear
vague
all the different
and useless
different
terminology.
I know, they are so useless.
I'm so thrilled to hear you say that.
They are.
A vendor who makes something that matters declare those things
well,
nonsense.
Well, the government, NHTSA, put those together. And we are visiting NHTSA, and we're trying to get some clarification, but even they are confused at their own. Anyway.
Yeah, every one of our customers we talk to has a different interpretation of those levels. So, I mean, David's in a sense correct that the customers don't necessarily, because everyone's saying something slightly different and doing something slightly different. But he's being modest in that. I mean, we still, because of his rich history as well as our leadership, I mean, we supply to basically everyone in the AV space today. And so we do have a pretty unique perspective on where the industry is and what the needs are. And so from that perspective, I think we know what's needed.
To be really clear here, the breakpoint at which LiDAR, in your opinion, is absolutely mandatory to deploy a safe vehicle in which a human is not in control, is that, would you define that as level 4? Is this a binary thing?
Well,
hands off requires LiDAR.
I would say level 3, 4, mm-hmm. and 5. People either say 3 doesn't exist, or I would bundle 3 with 4 and say that you need autonomous intelligence. That's what some Japanese professor called it, and I love the term. It's the ability to drive autonomously, but you're using it as for safety. You're using it for advanced safety. And you can click that button on and drive your parent home who has had a heart attack.
So right now, the GM has just deployed Super Cruise, which does not have onboard LiDAR, but operates because there is a LiDAR-sourced high-resolution map, and they've geofenced interstates. And I've deeply, deeply compared Super Cruise to Autopilot. And Super Cruise's path planning is way better than Tesla's. And everyone believes it's because of the LiDAR map. Is it possible, or do you even believe that it's possible to deploy fleets of driverless vehicles without LiDAR, or is LiDAR absolutely essential for this?
Absolutely essential.
Are you saying that because you're Velodyne?
No. I'm saying that because I have researched it. You absolutely need a mathematical, precise brain to be making these important decisions about safety.
That was the first half of our very interesting conversation with Dave Hall, founder of Velodyne, Marta Tomahal, president of Velodyne, and Anand Gopalan, the CTO. Come back later to hear part two of our conversation with the three quarters of the team behind this very fascinating company.